Hey everyone, and welcome to this, a Soapbox edition of the Risky Business Podcast. My name's Patrick Gray. Soapbox isn't the regular weekly show we do here at Risky.biz. If you are looking for that, just scroll one podcast back in your feed. Soapbox is a fully sponsored podcast series we do where vendors pay to come on and talk about research they've done, products they've launched, whatever they want. Really? And this edition of Soapbox is a particularly good one. Ryan Callumber is the Executive Vice President of Cybersecurity Strategy at Proofpoint, and he is our guest. Ryan was on the show a little while back talking about the concept of VAPs, very attacked people. And in this interview, he's going to expand on that a bit. It's one thing to know that some of your key people are being attacked, but let's take it one step further. Of those people, who among them is most likely to actually do something like click on a shady link? What do we know about those users that can tell us how at risk they are based on how frequently they're attacked and also how likely they are to engage with things like phishing attempts or dodgy attachments? And if they are a risky user, what can you do about that? Measuring risk and trying to score it is only useful if you can do something about it. And as you'll hear, Ryan has some ideas on what you can do once you've actually done this sort of risk scoring on your user base. So that's the gist of what we talk about. There's other stuff in there too, of course. So Ryan, join me to talk all about VAPs and approaches to dealing with that problem. And I started off by asking him to explain how all this works. And here's what he said.
It's really a combination of scoring the attacks themselves in terms of, are they interesting? Really taking actually what our smart customers were already doing, basically picking out, all right, this is a customer ad. It went to three people. I really care about that. Versus, and this is a commodity banking Trojan that went to the entire universe, actually making sure you can differentiate the threats themselves and then add the user susceptibility angle to it. In this threat landscape, which largely revolves around human-activated threats, it's a really interesting way to start actually going from theory on the what is my threat model, who are the people that are my VAPs, to actually analytics.
Yeah, so it is interesting when you start tying those two things. I mean, it's, you know, classic risk modeling stuff, right? But I can't really think of too many people who've taken this approach in the past of looking at, you know, who are the people who are most likely to be attacked and then sort of, you know, looking at the risk those users present based on their behaviors as well, right? So how do you even begin to start measuring that though? Because I'm guessing that's probably one of the reasons people haven't done this in the past.
Yeah, no, exactly. And everybody wants to know where to start. The thing that's very helpful from our perspective is, you know, the attackers are actually telling you who's interesting on a fairly regular basis, right? By who they're persistently targeting and who they're targeting with good stuff. So if you're stopping a bunch of that, even if you're not stopping 100% of it, it's still possible to learn from it. So every threat that comes in from the email side, and we actually do this for those kind of brute forcey password spray cloud attacks too, we just give it a score. Based on how much spread there was in the attack itself, and again, whether the payload's interesting, whether we have an actor that we can associate with it, and then we just model that 1 to 1,000, and then we do a little bit of fancy math. It's not data science at that point, really. It's just kind of some clustering and some things like Euclidean magnitude, which is a super nerdy math concept that turns out to be useful in making sure that, you know, somebody who got one really interesting threat stands out versus somebody whose email address is all over the internet and is just getting a bunch of commodity junk. Like, we don't want to have, you know, 1,000 junky crypto miners score the same as one APT threat. Right? Yeah. So if you can kind of model that, that gets really, really interesting.
So that's the first part of the problem, right? And I reckon that's probably the easiest one to tackle is you look at who's getting the interesting malware, right? And how frequently. Yes. That's going to give you, you know, something that will be useful down the track. But the second part, I'd imagine, is the harder part, which is how do you then start modeling how risky a user is? Like, where do you draw that insight from? Is that from spear phishing tests internally or, you know, those types of exercises? Like, where do you get that information from?
That is a really good question. And actually, the only thing I'd add to the first part is it's not just targeted malware, actually targeted cred fish.
In a lot
of cases is an interesting thing to throw into the mix because it means somebody's interested in that person's access. They're not just casting a wide net. But yeah, when it comes to assessing, you know, what we would call vulnerability, phishing simulation is really useful, although it's not a perfect score.
It's so uneven unless you're doing it. If you're doing it regularly, it sort of turns into a pain in the ass. And if you're not doing it regularly, you kind of don't collect enough data to have a decent sample, do you? And people are unpredictable. Exactly. Like someone has a bad day, they're going to be more or less like, you know, you just never know what has influenced a user's likelihood of clicking on a bum link.
Right. And there's another way to assess it, which is a little bit unfair, but frankly, for our purposes, is a useful data point, which is who's actually clicked on something bad in the past. You know, we rewrite all those URLs. So if somebody has a threat in their inbox, it's a rewritten URL. If they click on it, we're going to know that. Whether it's, you know, actively bad and we catch it at click time, or it's something that we're already blocking access to.
That's interesting, actually, because you do rewrite your URL, so you're going to capture all of that data.
Yeah, exactly. And so it'll be a bit unfair in that only certain people even get an opportunity to do that, assuming we're doing our jobs well. But that said, somebody who's actually clicked on a real threat, some people actually do it incredibly persistently. We've seen people click on the link that will not get them through to the badness 10, 15, 25 times because they're really,
I really want to see those funny cats.
Exactly. And sometimes it's more complex lures that involve 4, 5, 6 clicks in these really wonky attack chains that you wouldn't think would work, but they actually do. All of those things are good inputs. The other ones are things you get from Office 365, right? We know to a large extent, if we're connected to those APIs, who's coming in from a weird set of networks, right? New SSIDs all the time, captive portals, things that just generally correlate with risk. And to some extent, from a user agent and login perspective, we also get a indirect measure of device health, similar to, you know, what the Duo guys get.
Yeah.
And all of that, it has...
You caught that too, huh? That was interesting when we did that. It was a sponsor interview with Duo where they're like, yeah, we just do a banner grab basically on the user agent and use the patch level of the browser as a proxy for general system health. And that's a really good idea. But yeah, it's funny, right? So you're doing something similar there.
Yeah, exactly. Where we have the O365 access.
Yeah.
And if you put that together, you have a reasonably good idea of who's getting targeted with interesting stuff and who is likelier than most to fall for it. And the nice thing about that is it shrinks the problem pretty amazingly. You know, even at a large global bank with tens of thousands of people in it, sometimes hundreds of thousands of people in it, over any given period of time, they're only likely to have a few hundred that ever get targeted with interesting stuff. And so, again, you can kind of pick and choose controls for those people that you wouldn't do across your entire user population.
Okay, so that's the answer to my next question, right? Because, you know, a theme that we've been discussing on the show lately quite a bit is this idea of, you know, deception approaches in web applications, right? Some people say, yeah, you can, you know, build funny little parts of applications so you can tell when someone's having a go at them. You know, and I'm of the view and the Thinkst people are of the view that, well, okay, that's fun, right? But what do you do if you know someone's attacking you? Like, how does that actually give you any type of advantage over the attacker? So the question here is like, you know, what's the advantage to collecting and compiling and crunching this information? And you're saying that you can, you know, use this as an approach to decide who needs additional controls.
Yeah, exactly. You might not be able to take local admin away from 100% of the computers in your environment, but you can sure take it away from the 100 riskiest people.
Yeah.
You know, especially because, you know, in our experience, when somebody from the security team goes and actually talks to that user who's being persistently targeted and says, look, you're amazingly important to somebody. Let's talk about how to make sure that you don't get us breached. You know, they're more open to that because they've gotten the ego boost, and you can do some hygiene things. You can take away their MFA exemptions. You can do a few other technical things, again, like things like browser isolation, which don't scale to user populations, but end up being really, really valuable ways to make an attacker's job harder if they're consistently going after the small set of targets.
So is this something you've been working with clients on, and how receptive have they been?
Yeah, we've been working with pretty much our entire customer base on this. We've run these reports, actually, and they're, of course, in the dashboards and the APIs as well, but it's a really great conversation to have, and just in the last 90 days, we've done about 750 of them, which is pretty consistent for us over that kind of period of time, and it's always enlightening who those people are, because it either confirms your threat model or gives you some really interesting surprises. In healthcare in particular, it's not necessarily the vertical where the most threat modeling has been done, but we found actually this really interesting tie-in between, there's actually two words. If you have them in your title and you're a healthcare employee, it is vastly more likely that you will be a very attacked person. And the first word is nurse or nursing. The chief nursing officer is very often at the very top of the list. And the other one is pharmacy. That one should have been more obvious in retrospect.
So that's interesting. I'd imagine a chief nursing officer would get attacked because they're, by the nature of their job, going to have access to all of the patient information.
Yeah, exactly. The chief nursing officer has everything, whereas physicians are less interesting because they only have subsets. So if your end goal is patient data, chief nursing officers are perfect.
Yeah. Now, Ryan, you've told me earlier that some security shops actually do this type of profiling on user risk already. What type of organizations tend to do this?
Well, the more mature security shops have likely at least thought about these concepts before, usually through the lens of things like insider risk. Obviously, you see that in financial services pretty frequently where, you know, there was money at stake. That said, if you have some idea of a user's privilege level, that's another incredibly important thing to factor into the overall equation. Right? You have your people who are targeted, your people who are susceptible, and then your people who actually hurt you if they do get compromised. You know, I think there's a couple of different angles there that we found really, really fruitful. You know, Active Directory might not be perfect. In frankly, most shops, it's a cesspool. But it's at least directionally correct in terms of who has a high level of privilege.
Yes.
And there are always interesting security groups and entitlements that you want to look for, and you really especially want to look for in people that are being heavily targeted.
Well, and the nice thing about going straight to Active Directory is it'll show you, you know, who has privilege, who shouldn't.
You know? Yes.
Because how we... And look, I mean, that works on your Windows side. I don't know if people are... Are people really using Active Directory as their centralized single sign-on store for everything?
I mean, people do have the AD Azure set up to some extent. Other people use things like Okta's Universal Directory, which is cleaner in a lot of cases.
And other people just use multiple stores all over the place. Like, let's be honest, that's most orgs, right?
Yeah, chewing gum and baling wire, for sure. You know, but that said, even when you're able to shrink the problem to hundreds of users, you know, that's a great place to start for all kinds of the security products that we want to do these days. You know, whether they're the beyond Corpy zero trust kind of things, if you figure out that, hey, some of my developers who have access to Jenkins and need some things that are on-prem, maybe the source code repo is there, but they have some other things in the cloud. Maybe I really want to lock down their access because it represents a huge level of risk to my business. They write and DevOps run the applications that keep the cash flowing. Well, with zero trust, maybe I'll start there. Maybe I'll make sure that they can only get to those things. So if somebody else gets popped, they can't actually move over to that person's access.
Yeah.
And zero trust is a really difficult thing to implement at scale. I think the Google BeyondCorp journey that they described at RSA several years ago was something that felt daunting to a lot of people.
Well,
but
yeah,
anyway, you
right?
can kind of narrow it down. It's helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why, you know, Duo's whole marketing spiel was on, you know, they even called it BeyondCorp for the rest of us, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think any movement in this direction is a positive one, because whenever you can actually connect real risk analytics, the sort that every organization on the planet will have, and every organization on the planet has people, they have users, right? With everything that we are having on the menu now from a defensive controls perspective, you can start to actually focus on the greatest areas of risk in a way that actually makes sense for the business.
See, what I really love about this interview, Ryan, is that you've managed as an email security provider, as an API security, you know, filtering company, you've actually managed right now to just jump on the zero trust hype train. And it was it's amazing because it makes sense.
Absolutely. I think we'd be kicked out of RSA next year if we didn't, at least.
No, but look, what you're saying makes perfect sense, right? Because that is, so, you know, there's a CISO from an organization everybody would know, let's just say that, who's a friend of mine who, you know, is one of these legacy large organizations, not a tech company. And he's gone in there and I remember speaking to him, like a company in a similar type of company suffered a major data breach. And I got in touch with him and I'm like, you know, what's your take on this? And he said, look, you know, we're all dealing with the same set of issues, straining, groaning under several tons of technical debt here. So what we're trying to do is zero trusty, beyond corpy, the important bits and the new stuff, and trying to like accelerate the other stuff bleeding out. And that seems to be the approach. But I guess what you're saying here is that you can take this type of intelligence and apply it to, you can use it to prioritize your efforts, I guess is what you're saying.
Well, exactly, because the attackers are prioritizing theirs. You know, they're not absolutely scattershot in terms of how they use their good stuff. So most organizations are not necessarily connecting that notion to how they do the prioritization. How are you actually getting attacked every day? You know, this is why I kind of love the notion of if we had CVSS scores for people. It's like, you know, what goes into a CVSS score? You know, we are all internet facing. That's the first thing that matters. It's all pre-auth. If I can get a Word macro in front of you and get you to run it, that's RCE, right? We're all kind of 10 out of 10 if we're susceptible to these sorts of attacks. And critically, we have the opportunity to click on those attacks because we're being targeted. You know, that's the sort of thing that actually can unify what you probably already understand you want to do, but may not have the ability to work through all the cruft to actually prioritize in your environment.
It's funny that people just generally in discussions don't seem to think local privesc is a big deal, local privesc bugs. And, you know, this podcast is going to be run a few weeks after this recording, right? But I'm currently sitting here reading news of, you know, Sandbox Escaper's latest LPE. I'm just curious. I know this is a bit of a tangent, but I would think that a company like yours would regard local privesc on Windows boxes to actually be a pretty big deal, because you would see an awful lot of it going into users' inboxes.
It's a huge deal, and Sandbox Escaper is a bit of a roll lately with the LPEs, for sure.
It's like, nice work, but slow down.
Yes, exactly. And that's one of the reasons I like tying it back to things like...
Well, and the reason I brought this up is because we're talking about this from a CVSS point of view, right? Like, as you were talking, I was thinking, well, you know, but it's only, you know, if it's a lockdown user account, like that would limit your CVSS score. But if you chained it, you know, if you actually chained it, considered the person part of the bug chain, and then chained that up with a local privesc, like all of a sudden things are looking pretty serious.
Exactly. And that, I think, is one of those things that's even gotten to the CIO level. You know, I was actually having a conversation with a CIO of a Fortune 5 company recently.
Fortune 5? I didn't even know there was a Fortune 5, but yeah.
There is a Fortune 5, yes. you have to be implausibly gigantic to be a Fortune 5.
Yeah.
But the amazing thing was what was keeping him up was that local privesc. You know, it was how the red teams in his own organization and everyone he brought in from external sources had always compromised them and moved laterally around. And to a large extent, you know, that... Well, if you can do LPE, well, that's a big if, and wouldn't you like to know? And ideally, cut off most of the easy ways the attackers can get in with that first foothold and then start to move around. Now, pairing that up actually can reduce, I think, a tremendous amount of risk. And we've actually seen that in practice, you know, where we've seen organizations actually use this data, figure out who's being attacked. Yes, it's great to train those users better. Yes, it's great to know which of them will click on things. That's very important. But some of those technical controls, either things you implement like isolation or tighter policies around email or web or whatever you do from that perspective, but really the hygiene stuff, no MFA exemptions, no local admin, that has meaningfully reduced the amount of attackers that are able to get into those nightmare scenarios.
So that was really going to be my next line of questioning, which is, surely you've seen this put into action and how did it go? And you're saying it works quite well. But my question is, like, how often do you see attackers then come back using different techniques and going after the same organization?
Frequently is the short answer. One of the things that this has also helped us do is kind of rethink the entire notion of campaigns. Right? Because before, a campaign for us was, hey, it's Emotet today, or actually Emotet has been on vacation for about 10 days, so maybe I'll use a different example. It's the Panda campaign today, and they're, you know, sending out things that we can link up to their infrastructure, you know, lots of different hash values, several different URLs, but they're reusing a lot of it, and the campaign is the campaign today. A campaign probably better defined, though, is, hey, I'm seeing the same actor targeting a group of people in a particular business function, and they're doing it over a very long period of time. This is where actually clustering this activity has really showed us a lot about how these attacks evolve. So I'll give the example of a global retailer. Pretty much anyone they had that had a title on LinkedIn that is a China associate got targeted by this one actor, is a nation state affiliated actor, but one that freelances. So if anyone knows Gorgon Group or Subot, or we call them Threat Actor 470 because we use boring names. But basically, this retailer was seeing everybody with that title who was basically involved with their Chinese supply chain get targeted over a long period of time. And they would come back and they would use slightly different techniques. So, you know, one phase was Word macros, one phase was PDFs with links in them. Sometimes it was CredFish. But we were actually able to connect up a lot of activity that we previously hadn't even figured out was part of this targeting, because it was a really long-running campaign that was persistent by that actor. However, because it was such a long-running campaign, the security team had plenty of time to actually engage with these people, to tell them they were being persistently targeted, to actually do a practice phishing simulation with one of the lures that was in a phishing email that we had blocked, and really actually prepare them for the one, if, God forbid, gets through and ends up in their inbox. And they're that much less likely to click on it. And of course, they're able to also, you know, in the UEBA system or the SIM in this case, they're able to watch those users a little bit more carefully because they know they're being persistently targeted by an actor they care about.
Make any alerts for these 300 users show up red.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the sort of connection with the kind of classic security fabric that you can build pretty easy bridges to people as long as you're thinking about the problem that way. And I think increasingly I always go back to this one because it's my favorite episode of Risky Business ever, the Rich Mogul one. You know, you talk about, you know, infrastructure as a service taking over from anything you would run in a data center, all the back office going to SaaS, endpoints becoming more secure and less managed. What is left to target? You know, it's going to be the people. And you still want to connect that, though, with the rest of your security fabric, all the other controls that you have that are at your disposal, but prioritization is critical because you can't just do the same things for everybody. You can't dial up monitoring for all users because that's not really dialing up anything at all. And so actually kind of connecting all of these data points has been useful at the operational level. And the other thing that I think, you know, we don't spend a ton of time talking about, but matters a lot to day-to-day CISO life, is how do you then kind of take what you're doing and present it up to management and the board and other business units? Oftentimes, that's an extremely difficult proposition to translate.
Oh, this is the sort of stuff that would absolutely kill in a slide deck, right? Like, because it's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to be sitting there talking to a bunch of non-InfoSec people, and once you can make some pretty charts and, you know, I mean, just the concept's interesting, right? So it's going to have that going for it. It's definitely entertaining. Makes for a good podcast, too.
No, indeed. And it's the sort of thing that's, you have a septuagenarian board member who, you know, has a tablet and understands a little bit of about technology, but you're not really going to explain the significance of local PrivEsc to that guy or girl, woman, rather. That's going to be a challenging conversation to have if you're trying to put it in board language, that is the language of risk, and you're trying to jump straight from technical risk to actually, you know, the board presentation. Here, you know, we're talking about that retailer. Yeah, well, the Chinese supply chain, that matters a lot. Risks to that. What could be disrupted here? What could the attacker want to do? What actually could that mean to the business? It's not nearly as much of a leap as it can often be from, you know, the traditional things we use as InfoSec metrics.
It's interesting, man. Just thinking of like the number of developers that these large companies have. Like, I know someone who recently moved to the United States, who's a developer, picked up a job with Amazon, and their whole job is just working on localization features, right? And that's a job, and it's probably part of like a 100-strong team, right? When you start thinking about, and I wonder sort of what privileges and what access they have. Anyway, that's a conversation for a different day. One thing I wanted to ask you, though, is like, why did you start off looking at this beyond the idea that it's interesting? Was this something where, you know, you were just thinking about doing some value-added research to keep your larger clients happy? Were you doing it because it was interesting? Were you doing it because there is going to be a commercial offering at the end of this? You know, I'm just a little bit interested in the history of why you've done this.
This one came 100% from our customers. A couple of CISOs actually, we were in a discussion, and two of them, in fact, were really hung up on the fact that the attackers, in their opinion, knew how their businesses worked better than their own security teams did. And that, to some extent, makes sense, right? Security team needs to know what the network diagram looks like. They need to know what the assets are. They need to know patch levels and, you know, whether
but the attackers have an org chart.
The head tackers have an org chart.
Exactly. Well, I mean, you see a lot of these finance crews, right? Like, who was that crew? I don't know. I can't remember if it was Fin7, but, you know, they'd even created their own screen recording software so that they could sneak.
That's Fin7.
Yeah, it was Fin7. So they'd sneak onto a box where the person's doing the, you know, the international money transfers and stuff and just watch them for a couple of weeks to learn their workflow. I always said that, you know, the people involved in those sort of crimes, they would know an awful lot about the inner workings of banks, and they'd probably actually be quite good working there if they decided to give up their crime, you know?
Yeah, and the whole Cobalt side of Fin7 has been extraordinarily good at learning business processes, but it's not just the banks that have to worry about this now. You know, the other side of Fin7 has been going after retailers that haven't always had the best security, restaurant chains, chains of what we call in the U.S. truck stops. There's one absolutely fantastic Fin7 thread where we obviously block the malware as part of it. But, you know, the guy is not fully cognizant of all American, you know, traditions. So his lure in this case is he's going back and forth with this person who he wants to place a catering order with. Obviously, the catering order is going to contain the back door. And he's trying to celebrate a child's birthday party with cinnamon rolls at a truck stop, not usually a place where one celebrates a child's birthday.
Well, I cannot wait to take my child to an American truck stop for her birthday.
So he's going back and forth with this very nice customer service rep who he's exchanged four or five emails with already to build some rapport, and he actually tries to give her the catering order, which of course is going to actually contain a macro, which is going to download their backdoor. She doesn't get it because, of course, we block it because it's malware. She comes back, actually, and says, oh, I didn't get your email, after he's followed up a couple of times. And then he's like, oh, no problem. I really don't want to spoil my son's birthday. He tries to send it again. We block it again. And then finally he emails one more time, and she replies, can't you just fax it? And he clearly did not actually go to that Black Hat talk last year about the Faxploit malware, because he didn't seem to have any fax malware. And actually, he went to the other logical option, which is asking her what her personal email address was, so we can try and get on the computer that way.
Yeah. But I can think of like so many times where I've legitimately had to do that to send legitimate information to people that I'm dealing with, you know? And that's the peril of overblocking, right?
Right, exactly. And it's the other side of kind of this whole equation, right? We've got attacks that don't really work without human intervention, right? We are our own RCE in this case. And you have adversaries who are persistent and are human themselves. They're happy to switch channels. They're happy to conduct conversations. And that's been one of the big trends in the malware landscape, towards this more modular malware family orientation that can actually lead to better profiling of infected systems and some hands-on keyboard work for the adversaries post-infection as well. It's a really, really big change from the spray and pray ransomware banking Trojan days. And I think it requires us to understand the whole landscape a little differently. And it's what's inspired us to basically redo all of our analytics so that we're surfacing the more interesting threats and the more targeted people, and helping people build better controls around them.
So you said that initially this was customer driven, right? So they were coming to you saying, this is the sort of information that we would like to have because we want to use it for XYZ. So it was a customer led thing. Is this something now that you are going to package up and like offer to other organizations?
Well, a lot of it's free, right? If you already have the products, we added threat scoring into the core email products, the advanced threat detect products. They all come with a view into who your very attacked people are. They actually give you some detail in terms of how we scored the threats and why, based on how many organizations they affected, how many individual people they targeted, as well as, you know, what we knew about the actor.
So already you can just go, you know, give me my top 100 attacked people that get hit with interesting stuff, not commodity stuff. And I can go to a Proofpoint console and strip that out pretty easy.
It's already in there, and we do stacked bar charts with exactly, you know, how much of the threat score came from rats versus phishing. And you can actually compare actually people who get phished with people who get interesting malware. It's often very different groups of people. And then you also start to surface things like these shared mailboxes, which have bedeviled lots of security teams lately. Mm. They're useful to the attackers because, of course, it's hard to MFA them. Even if it doesn't look like a very targeted attack, it goes to lots of different recipients internally, typically. Fin7 loves these, for the record, as do a lot of other actors. And it helps surface you know, risk you didn't know you had. The other things that we think are going to be really useful long term is, from our perspective, you know, we have a lot of different products. We've got the email stuff, we've got the CASB stuff, we've got the DLP stuff. We want to be able to actually have a common point of orientation. So whether you're consuming that data through APIs or our own dashboards, if we circle more and more around people and, again, help you shrink those problems. This, again, I have to go back on the zero trust bandwagon briefly. You know, you might have seen a couple of weeks ago, we acquired a company called Meta Networks, based in Israel. Really, really, really brilliant engineers. Their whole thing is basically, it's kind of that your definition of zero trust, right? Everything is public Wi-Fi. Nothing is trusted whatsoever. Yeah. But what they do is IPv6 address for everybody, because, you know, there's plenty of those to go around, and then user-level access policies. Most of the time, that's for high-risk user groups, third parties, contractors, etc., that need access to things, but you have a big flat network, you don't want to give them access to that. We're actually seeing people now adopt this for their very attacked people. Right? Again, start with where you have real risk informed by real attackers, going back to, you know, the customers who inspired this to begin with. Show me who my interesting people are to the attackers, and help me then build better controls.
So hang on, you're putting your high-risk people on it on a separate V6 network.
Yeah, exactly. And you're basically saying, so if one of your high-risk people is one of those developers, they need access to three systems on-prem and two in the cloud, just say, well, you can only get to those systems through these IPv6 ranges that are specific to those users. So you have to be logged in, MFA'd there before you even reach that. And then if you're a third-party contractor or something, you're not just joining the big flat network. So if you're popped, you don't have access to everything. Maybe you only have access to one or two things.
It's a really interesting idea, because that never would have occurred to me that you could actually kind of create, I mean, it's not a VLAN, right? Because you're not going for privacy by doing this with V6. But what it does is it creates a network within a network that's very small and very visible.
Yeah, exactly. And you can cloud deliver the whole thing, because all you have to do is put one of these little, it's kind of like a pop, you know, and set it up wherever you want. You obviously, if it's a, if you have a big data center somewhere, you want to set it up nearby. If you have a cloud service that you're trying to give people access to, say you're in Amazon West in Oregon or Amazon East in Virginia, you know, have the egress point near there. IPv6 gives you all kinds of really nice granular control over that. And, you know, in my view, it's one of the more elegant ways to try and do zero trust, because it avoids a lot of the classic challenges that the sort of software-defined perimeter approaches have.
Ryan, you were recently on the show talking about sort of targeted password spraying. I'd imagine that factors into your risk scoring here.
One of the things that I go back to is, why are we doing this to begin with? The first and biggest orienting principle for us is always, is this actually going to work against our adversaries? You know, that's the big thing that we care about. And those password spray attacks, as annoying as they are, they do work. And they work at an absolutely phenomenal rate. So that's one thing that we've actually started to bundle into that, what we call the attack index core, you know, who is getting the most attacked. So that even if you're not getting phished, you're not getting something that we're stopping that's maybe directed at you that you could potentially interact with. The other side of that coin, and again, Office 365 has opened up this attack surface, as has G Suite to some extent, are things like those IMAP logins or all of those things that you haven't disabled. So being able to actually have a unified picture of that is incredibly useful in identifying the full spectrum of the ways that people can be attacked. You know, there are some other ones that are a little bit longer tail and more esoteric. In theory, you could get attacked by a coworker's compromised account, for example. Or like our Fin7 example, you can get attacked via personal webmail. Those are a little bit harder to build analytics around. It's really more a matter of, you know, on the internal side, are you actually even inspecting internal mail? G Suite does it by default, for the record. Office 365 doesn't really do a good job with that. Exchange servers obviously do nothing. And then on the webmail side, really, are you blocking it? Are you allowing it? Is this really a viable threat vector? Because we have seen lots of attackers pivot over to that when they can't succeed on plan A, which is usually corporate email.
No, it's interesting that you mentioned the long tail stuff there, because, I mean, I wonder if there are some of those so-called long tail things that are really high quality indicators. Have you had any pop out that are just like, well, if this happens, then it tells us a great deal? Or is it more just about, you know, sort of cumulative risk scoring?
So some of the long tail stuff is indeed really interesting. And one of the ways that that actually enters into the operational flow is when you actually allow users to report it. So one of the ways that we have seen long tail stuff like webmail attacks actually make its way back into the security fabric is if a user says, all right, this looks like phishing, I'm going to send it to my security team or my abuse mailbox, and they'll take a look at it. This is actually a really interesting component to the model. And when we were talking earlier about kind of quantifying susceptibility, you know, there's one really interesting aspect to that, which is that some people are so resilient.
Well, this I was just thinking of this, like you might actually wind up like scoring someone down because they're just spotting everything.
Yes, absolutely. And we do that pretty frequently because it is one of the better ways to quantify the people you don't want to actually spend as much time focusing on. And at the same time, if they do report something, it's likely to have a high signal-to-noise ratio, so you do want to take a look at it.
And you might want to see if that's popping up in other mailboxes.
Exactly. And a lot of that can be automated, right? Anytime a user basically submits a report, you know, either it's because it's a simulated phish and we say, yeah, good job, or they're submitting something they think is a false negative that ended up in their inbox. You know, most of the time, users actually are an incredibly interesting source of threat intel, and that actually is a great way to factor into the susceptibility equation, you know, the people who genuinely report good stuff. I actually heard from a colleague at one of the think tanks that is perhaps, it certainly would be one of the top three most influential ones in all of InfoSec. And they said actually their best source of threat intel was user reports out of email.
Indictment on other sources of threat intel there, though, isn't it? I mean, it's good news, but it's bad news for others.
Oh, I'll tell you offline who it is. It's absolutely amazing. But I think actually it also goes to the fact that, you know, they had built automation to look at what users are reporting. A lot of organizations haven't. You know, they might have an abuse mailbox set up, but they're not actually doing anything around that. You know, we actually released quite a bit of capability around the same tools that we use to automate the cleanup of regular phishing, which is, again, something that far too many security teams spend far too much time on, to basically send user-reported potential phish through the same flows. Insofar as you can identify really good stuff there, you would be able to identify it either post-delivery to an inbox or pre-delivery to an inbox. It doesn't really matter. So you can still use the same kind of threat intel extraction tool.
Well, Ryan Callumber, mate, it's been interesting as always. Thanks a lot for joining us. Really do appreciate it, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Pleasure as always, Pat.
That was Ryan Callumber of Proofpoint there. Big thanks to him for that. You can find Proofpoint, of course, at proofpoint.com. And that is it for this edition of the Soapbox Podcast. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.